It's Lucky's Really Long List of Movies. Wow. If Pulp Fiction is the movie that taught me how to chill out and watch movies, then Parasite is the movie that taught me I'm gonna need more time behind the scenes to produce each episode. I need time to digest and take in safely. So for starters, Parasite is a good fucking movie. This is a really good movie. It had a very real and heavy message, but it was also fun and thrilling, and it was a movie. But digesting this message took a couple of days. I watched Parasite for the first time a week ago. Then I watched it again about 2 days later. And that might be the last time I can watch this movie for a while, because my literal brain, this little jar of marbles sitting on top of my shoulders, was aching. It burned. The message that came with this movie was more like a mirror, and the reflection was affirming in regards to how I viewed the rich, but it was also personal because I related so hard with the family, especially when their money situation kept changing. The message made me feel screwed, seen, and also like a warning as well. Not only did I write my first takedown, like I watched the movie once and then I wrote out my thoughts and feelies, but I had to write down a second take after I watched it the second time. But my second take will probably just end up structuring this episode, maybe. I don't know. I haven't even done the research yet. I'm currently afraid to research because of how real this could get. And I really wanted to learn more about the filmmaker as well, because he wrote and directed this masterpiece. Yeah, I said it. Yeah, a masterpiece. This movie was a masterpiece. I couldn't find anything wrong with it. I couldn't find anything wrong. Not like I was looking, right? Because I've learned not to do that. This movie intentionally scrambled my brain, but in a good way. Let's see what I find and if the research actually is healing. I don't know. Let's just see what I find with research. And now it's time to share my first take. All right, so my first take after watching Parasite for the first time. Holy smokes. This movie was good. And let me just take a moment to thank everyone who yelled at me to watch this movie. And an even bigger thank you for not saying a word about the plot. And the biggest thank you for the first person who almost yelled at me to watch this movie. I'm not going to use your real name because I'm not using my real name, but I gave you a nickname. Garlisha Pusey, this was one hell of a movie, and thank you so much for recommending it. And that's why this movie made it to the list, and that's why it's in one of the first episodes of this entire project. And damn, it was a really fucking good one. So thank you so much, Garlisha Pusey. So I went in as blind as I thought I could. I had such a big reaction to seeing The Rock being introduced. I was like, it's The Rock. Oh, that's John Cena. Whatever. I had a really big reaction to seeing The Rock. I'm curious as to what type of rock that is and if it's significant. And the relationship between The Rock and the son, Ki-Woo. God, and the dad, Ki-Tek. The dad started out as such a sweet and cute, simple man. Maybe he didn't like pull his weight too much, but I mean, he was optimistic. And that in itself is really hard to do. And then he turned into a murderer. I shouldn't be laughing at that. I think I missed the reason why the daughter died. I assumed suicide, but I couldn't piece all that together clearly. I know. Hi, this is Future Lucky. I know. How can I forget? How can I forget how the fucking daughter died? Like, this was a real experience I had. I realized I couldn't remember when the daughter died because I couldn't recognize her. Because she fit in so well with all the rich, gross, disgusting people. And like her like little white dress. Like I couldn't. Like she didn't look like herself. All right. Future Lucky out. It was a mind fuck. On top of a mind fuck. On top of a mind fuck. It was a mind orgy. Anyway. So the mom worked the entire time. And she was a badass. Or maybe she was dissociating because she straight up donkey kicked that lady down the steps. And then a day later, she was prepping a gourmet plate of food for them. Oh my God. And the guy who's living in the basement, creepy. Or was he just going crazy, you know, from like living in a hole and on scraps from the rich people walking around overhead? Oh my God. The rich people. The rich people. That's really how they act. I wish I could say that there was at least one exaggeration in regards to their behavior, but there wasn't. That's really how they act. I really see them behave this way. I hate how they think they're different. I hate how they don't understand the only differences between them and the rest of us is just like currency. The rich people fucking suck. Here's something to research. What do the rich think about this movie? Do they get it? Oh God, and when Ki-Woo is first going into that house, ugh. And going into a rich person's house when you're poor as shit and is such a sickening experience. But this movie had such a rebellious tone to it. Like showing the suffering of one group and a gross intake of resources from another group. And like the differences between class and society. Like this situation in Parasite, the movie, you know, like people like coming in, trying to take over the house, money changing the fucking nature of good people. Money has a weird mental hold on all of us. It could make you go crazy. And now my brain feels numb because of all the thinking. And that was my first take on this entire movie. It just really made me angry. And then I wasn't angry at the movie. The movie felt like it was not on the rich people's side. And that felt nice to me. This movie is full of themes and symbolism and motifs. I learned what those were. I learned what a motif was and I learned what a symbol was. A symbol is something that's used once. A motif is a symbol that's used more than once within the movie. The motifs point back to the theme. I'm learning. As a movie, this is also just a good movie. It's just a good movie. You want to sit down and have a good time? Watch the first half of the movie. But then you're going to be so locked in that the second half of the movie, damn. The second half of the movie is the reason why people do not tell you the plot of Parasite. This movie doesn't stop blowing my fucking brains. I'm going to go ahead and move on with the rest of this podcast. And what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to go beat for beat in the movie. And I didn't mean to do this, but I had to do it because there's so many moments in this movie that I really wanted to talk about. And I have no one around me to talk about it with. I mean, I do have people, but they're not going to let me talk straight for an hour. So let's get it going. Let's talk about the families. The actors are amazing. Every actor that was on screen was amazing to the point to where I forgot I was watching a movie and I was like, these are real people. And the houses were so starkly different and they played such a major role in the storytelling that they are also main characters in this movie. And the houses did a beautiful performance as well. Okay, so there are two families. The Park family. And the Kim family. The main difference between the families is their wealth, or lack thereof. Both families have a mom, dad, daughter, and a son. The Park family is very, very wealthy, which is rare. And the Kim family is very, very poor, which is common. The movie starts with the introduction of the Kim family. Who the Kim family is at the beginning of the movie and who they become in the middle and then where they end up at the end are completely different. And the change that happens to this family is such a reflection of capitalist culture. I'm just saying they all change because, like, money, the influence of money, or having to lose money, or the threat of losing money, really heavily influences how they act, how they treat each other, how they treat other people, how they treat people that have more money, how they treat people that have less money. Like, they all just change. But I think the person who changed the least was the daughter, because she already fits in with the rich people. But I'm not going to get ahead of myself here. So the father of the Kim family is Kai Tech. And Kai Tech, to me, was a sweet man, you know, that always looked on the positive side of life, even though he has run through a lot of jobs and business ventures that ended up falling through. It's not like he did nothing. He still, like, folded boxes in the middle of, like, getting fumigated. He was positive. He didn't make the day harder. The mother of the Kim family, Chung Suk. Chung Suk is a hardworking, very down-to-earth, has a good and edgy sense of humor. She wasn't this delicate flower. She exhibited this athlete scholar discipline and would do what she had to do to make money for her family. Crocheting, folding pizza boxes, cleaning, working nonstop. But she really seemed like a cool mom. Not the kind that let you drink in her basement for fun. But she will bring in good, real energy to shitty situations and will persevere. You know, like, that's a cool mom. Then we have the daughter of the Kim family, Ki Jung. When we first see Ki Jung, she's in pajamas, long, probably overgrown hair. I'm also going to talk a little bit more about Ki Jung because I think she was my favorite and I thought she was so cool. And I don't know what that says about me and what I admire, because she changes the least throughout the movie because she fits in better with the rich people, who I hate. So Ki Jung is very smart and creative. She creates fake documents for her brother. She can act. She plays out all of these roles to get her family jobs within the Park household. She's also clever. She's also another actor who has cool cigarette acting skills. She did. She had cool cigarette moments. I just thought she was cool. Is that so bad? It might be. I don't know. And then we have the 6 foot tall son, Ki Woo. Ki Woo is introduced as a timid man with no confidence. Maybe his confidence was destroyed because he isn't in school, didn't have a plan. He was trying to exist as an example of a failure. He was also in the Korean military, maybe against his will, or did so as an attempt to have a plan. But he was in the service and is now living in a piss shack with, thank God, his family. Ki Woo is also very smart. He is kind of the brain of the whole fucking operation of the movie. Well, he is one of the brains in this heist-like plan that he creates. So after we get to know the Kim family, we are then slowly introduced to the Park family. The mother, Mrs. Park. Mrs. Park is labeled as a simple woman in the movie. I would describe her as paranoid and ignorant, but mainly paranoid. She seems to have this weird obsession with America, specifically white or rich America. She would randomly, maybe not random, but she would just, like, say random phrases in English. And she would buy her son, quote, Native American, unquote, toys, and trusted the quality in these items because they come from the U.S. and no other factors. And it seems that if you are an outsider to her, as long as you don't look poor, you have a white American name, and have lived in literally any state in America, she was sold on you, your character, your potential, everything. You're not an equal, but you're allowed to come into the house and be employed. Then we have the father, Mr. Park, the breadwinner, the moneymaker. He is some big-time CEO or something of a tech company that seems to just spew out technology for customers. It looks like the gadgets are entertainment-based, like drones, VR headsets or something, toasters that can do your taxes. I don't fucking know. It's basically worthless junk that only rich people can buy. He is a cold, emotionally unavailable man. He isn't militant, but he is stuck up. Stuck up his own ass. Then we have the kids. And it's hard for me to hate the kids because they are young kids. It's hard to really blame them. Then we have the daughter, Park Da-hye. She is a sophomore in high school. She does have a few characteristics that make her seem like a spoiled little brat. She whines about going on a family outing. She whines to her mom about food that was not saved for her. And she pouts when she thinks her new English tutor has a girlfriend. But honestly, she was a romantic. And she was a teenage girl in a concrete tower and has to spend the majority of her time studying. And then a cute tutor comes into her life and she is living out this little romance. But this also shows that class doesn't really matter to her at this point. But she is still ignorant about a lot. She's just a teenager. Then we have the little boy, Park Da-song. Da-song is a small little boy, very young, youngest in the cast. And he is a hyperactive little boy who has an obsession with Native Americans, but not really Native Americans, more so the white version or interpretation of Native Americans, which is gross. And it's a bit of a colonialism note in a movie called Parasite, where this note shares space with other critical notes about capitalism and society. As an American, I hear you loud and clear. This little boy makes these pictures and paintings, and they kind of look like scribbles that might resemble a familiar shape, like people and places. And Da-song also has trauma that is a bit of a mystery and leads to one of the scariest shots in the movie. Did you get fucking freaked out when you saw those eyes? Da-song has one of the scariest shots in the movie, and because of this trauma, he has seizures. And Da-song, being the baby of the family, receives a lot of that paranoid helicopter mom treatment from Mrs. Park. She thinks he's a genius because of his art. She is tortured about the possibility of another seizure and can almost not leave him alone or deny him of anything he wants. And now let's talk about the housekeeper. The housekeeper of the Park house. She was a major player in the Park family. She ran that fucking house. She was actually the housekeeper for the previous owner of the house. And when she is introduced, she is very professional. She's an expert of the house, seems to be very comfortable with the Park family. The house is also a reflection of her work. Everything is tight and tidy. The kitchen and the pantry are fully stocked and organized. The floors are waxed. The reflective surfaces are dust-free. And she is the only one completing the chores of this house. And this house is huge, but she has it under control. She also has a sweet relationship with the children. She plays with Da-song. She gives the teenage daughter her space and respect. And the housekeeper has the trust, or the closest thing you can get to trust, with Mr. and Mrs. Park. And the housekeeper also has a lot of like twists and turns. Like, she's such a crazy part of the story. Her husband is living underneath the house and the Park family doesn't know about it. She also is very resilient physically. She gets the shit beat out of her time and time again. It's nuts. Now we have the house, and then we have the home. This movie takes place in modern-day Korea within two houses, the Kim's home and the Park family's house, because there's a difference. Well, technically, one is a house, and the other one is a basement apartment. I'll start with the Kim's home. The Kim family lives in a basement apartment, and there is one window to this tiny apartment. It's not like a full-length window. It's just like a maybe a window that's maybe about like 6 inches tall or something. And when you look out of the window, you see the street at eye level, letting us know that this is a basement. This is a basement basement. The street shows other low-income houses, and there is a frequent visitor that is seen out of the window. The frequent visitor is a drunk who casually and frequently pees right out the window. And this is the window that they leave open for airflow. So this place probably smells like drunk hot pee, too. I would be angry. I almost said pissed. I would be angry if somebody was peeing out my window and all I could smell was your stinky drunk vodka pee. Tequila pee. Stay away from me. And when we are in this home, when we are in the Kim family home, there is constant movement. It's a bit frantic, but it really captures like the nonstop movement in poor households. There is no fucking rest. The kids are running around the house trying to find a Wi-Fi signal. The mom is crocheting with pink, out of place, you know, sparkly thread. And she's like talking to the kids about finding signal. The dad was sleeping on the floor, but not successfully because he's easily sprung up and he's joined in on the conversation. People are knocking on the door. It's a lively home in tight quarters. The condition of the house is overwhelming. There is stuff everywhere. There is laundry hanging in the window. I feel like there's just like boxes lining the wall. And there's also images on the wall of the mom when she was like shot putting her medals. The walls were dirty. The floor was as clean as they could keep it. It's dark and dingy and old. But even though the apartment was, well, it was shit, I could feel the life in this house. There was a pulse or something, or the family just, they lived there. And now let's take a dramatic pivot to the Park family's quote-unquote home. A fucking house. I hated this house. I hated this house so much. I think it's too big, too expensive, and super gross. I think it's ugly as well, and I'm very sorry if this is a real house, but it's more of like a fortress. It's not inviting. This thing is huge and cubical. Its exterior is a dark gray with dark brown accents. The lawn was plushy green. The entrance to the house is not seen from the street. Oh, no, no, no. Civilians cannot lay their eyes on this crapster piece. The house is obviously in some kind of gated community because the streets are silent and empty, and you have to walk up to a gate to be buzzed in, and you can't even see the house over the gate. It's very secluded. And after you are buzzed in, the gate will automatically open and close for you. This little moment, watching that gate open for Ki Woo when he goes in for that interview, it almost makes it look like the Park family lives in a different time than the Kim family. And it's just gross to me. So after you're buzzed in, the gate opens, whatever, you throw up, and then you walk in. You have to walk up these concrete steps, and then the house is revealed. Then you go into this concrete Goliath. The doors are like 20 feet tall. The interior of the house is not much different from the outside. Big, gray, cold, shiny, spacious, quiet. The only flicker of life in this house is the little boy's toys left about. But the housekeeper quickly cleans and puts everything back into its place. Or hiding. The furniture is artsy and big, but still not big enough to fill the space. All of their items are like tucked behind glass or they're on display like a depressing museum. Everything is unnecessarily high tech, like the garbage can, which I heard was actually over $2,000, and Bong Joon-ho thought it would be funny and ironic to have the big production company spend so much of their money and approve a purchase like this on such a silly thing. It was like a 1 gallon trash can, and you stepped on a lever. I think you stepped on a lever, or did it sense you coming? For $2,000, it better sense me coming. For $2,000, our menstrual cycles better be in sync. Like, are you fucking kidding me? The house has big rooms and giant staircases, ceiling to floor windows that go wall to wall. Bathtubs that are parked right in front of TVs. Just endless abundance of shit. But the vibe of the house was very corpse-like. It was cold, quiet, like no pulse. So much concrete everywhere. Colorless and just not a place for humans. We are warm. Humans, we're warm. And squishy beings. And we like to snuggle and cuddle and lay down on soft, plushy things.
And this house is like the opposite.
And places like this make me very uncomfortable. Houses and apartment buildings like this, stores for rich people, restaurants for rich people. It's just icky. But this movie really made me think, especially about how like the families start to change and their surroundings start to change, or at least for the Kims it did, and how much that money influence changed them. It made me think, like, what would I do? Would I do the same thing? I like to think that I wouldn't. I like to think that, you know, if I were to get like a shit ton of money, or if I were to have this abundance of bullshit, like, I like to think that I would give it back, give it away. Like, I would not hold on and hoard and try to protect it and like resource guard like a dog. That's what you think. And then you get it. And then all of a sudden you're kicking people down staircases. You know what I mean? So let's talk about the fun. Let's talk about the first half of the movie, huh? Let's lighten things up a little bit. So now let's get into the first half of the movie. So the movie is clearly in two halves, which is interesting because clear divides are a big theme in this movie. This screenplay was written by Han Jin-won and Bong Joon-ho. Bong Joon-ho is also the director and brought in the main influence for the script. It was written as a stage play originally, and then it was adapted to film. So the themes of Parasite are inspired by true crime and a classic 1960s Korean movie. The movie was The Housemaid, and it's about how a housemaid ends up gaining control of the household she was working for, and she does so in a really crazy way. And I read the breakdown of the plot, and I added it to the list because it sounds really fucking crazy, and I gotta see it. And it's from the 1960s! And the crew trime, and the crew trime? And the true crime inspiration is the 1930s incident of Christine and Leah Papin. This is a true story, a true crime story about how two sisters worked in a home back in the 1930s, and they were mistreated by the rich women and probably the other members of the household. Eventually, the abuse came to a head, and the two sisters attacked and brutally killed the mother and daughter of the household. And then things got really incestuous and very weird in this Papin case. So if you're interested, look into it at your own risk. Let's talk more about Parasite, the movie. The first half of the movie was more so looked at like a comedy, or it had the pacing of like a really fun heist movie. We see the plan form, the plan was practiced and executed, and no one seemingly got hurt. Also, in the first half of the movie, we are introduced to the Scholar's Stone, that rock. Remember telling you about that rock? This rock is brought in by one of Ki-woo's friends, Min. This friend is in way better standing than the entire Kim family combined. He has a job and he has plans to go off in the summer for school, and his family is wealthy. This fancy friend comes in and he takes off his shoes, customary, but he walks in eagerly. And just like for a split second, he like stops to check the bottom of his feet because the floor is dirtier than he is used to. But he keeps it pushing and he is excited to give this poor family this expensive item. He tells the family that this rock is supposed to bring in luck and wealth and all these good things, and that they are in every room of his rich relative's house. Oh, and you know how I mentioned the $2,000 that was dropped on the trash can in production? Well, this rock wasn't even a rock at all. It was actually one of two rocks made for the movie, and they are made from foam. And I know that they were made to look like specific, and they were made to look a specific way. And I know it's an art form for the rock, and the rocks probably cost just as much as the trash can, if not more. But it's just funny to me that the expensive rock was fake and the 1 gallon trash can was actually over $2,000. So this rock is so big and clumsy and such a tone-deaf gift to give someone poor. There is no real room for this rock in this basement apartment. And it comes in this obnoxiously fancy wooden custom case with gold embellishments, and it even has a custom pedestal. The family's reaction to the rock was polite. The mom did mutter words like,
food would have been better. But, you know, no hard feelings are made and the rock is accepted. And Ki-Woo, you know, he starts, this is kind of like where we first see him have that fascination with metaphors. He like holds up the rock and he's like, oh, it's a metaphor. That's perfect for us. And you want to talk about fucking metaphors? Okay, so let's just talk about this rock, the scholar rock. Scholar rocks, they're real. Basically, they're like rocks that have been worn down. That was my cat knocking over all of my mannequin heads and a lightsaber that is shooting out of the top of a giraffe's head. If you can give me just one moment, let me just go ahead and address that really quick. I'll be right back. So the scholar's stone, like, what is this rock? So a scholar's stone is a rock that has been weathered down by the elements, by nature. So, and I've seen these rocks, like some of them are pretty cool. Like some of them have like holes in them, like all over them. Some of them are like really tall and really curvy and wavy with holes in them. And, you know, I get it. I get the poetic meaning behind it. I can definitely see how this rock can be sitting on like a poet's desk, a scholar's desk, and then they get inspired because of the poetic meaning behind this rock. I mean, looking at it and realizing how it was made, right? You can be inspired and think like, oh, wow, like nature ages us in such beautiful ways. Or this rock has gone through it. So can I. Or, wow, the things that we go through, even though they leave holes and take chips off of us and wear us down, we can still be beautiful and admired in the end. Right? But then it gets gross and yucky when there's a price tag put on it. And then the price tag gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I think it is kind of ironic that rich people admire the value of this thing. If you're going to appreciate something that's been outside and weathered down by the elements, you know, there's like actual real living people that do that. They don't have like houses to be in. Yeah. You don't even want to give them money because you're scared of what they're going to do with it. But you'll bring this rock inside, though. You'll bring this rock inside. You'll get a really cool case for it. You'll get a really cool pedestal for it. And then you'll be like, it's beautiful because it's worn down by the weather and the elements from the outdoors. I don't know. I could just be an asshole. So I will accept that. If that makes me an asshole, okie dokie, I'm sorry. But I like the idea of looking at it and being like, wow. But I don't like the idea of looking at the price tag and being like, damn, you know? So Ki-Woo, the son, he goes out with his fancy friend to the deli, bodega, corner store. We all have different names for these lovely little places. While the two young gentlemen, using that sparingly, sit down to eat, the fancy friend asks Ki-Woo to take over his in-home tutoring client, the Park family, mainly the daughter. The daughter is a sophomore and needs English tutoring. The fancy friend was the tutor, but since he is going away for the summer, he wants Ki-Woo to take over his job. But he wants Ki-Woo to take over because if Ki-Woo doesn't stand in and take over his place, then some dumb frat boy will. And Ki-Woo, he starts to get self-conscious because he is not in school. But his friend reminds him of himself, and he reassures that Ki-Woo has what it takes to pull this off with his smarts and his time in the military. And the fancy friend also says that the wife, Mrs. Park, isn't even that bright. Ki-Woo then adopts a fake American name, Kevin, and has some false backstory that involves Kevin living in America and his accolades. So Ki-Woo gets his sister, Ki-Jung, to make some false documents that look like they come from an incredible school. And I love that computer cafe scene. It just looks really cool. And the sister acts like an edgy badass. She's smoking inside. So Kevin / Ki-Woo, he goes to the Park home for the first time for his interview. And this is the first time we see this giant, ugly ass house. He goes in and, you know, he's greeted by the housekeeper. She takes him around the house. Then the housekeeper's like, just wait here. Mrs. Park is just sleeping outside. Let me go get her really quick. Ki-Woo was able to look out the window into the backyard and sees that Mrs. Park is like passed out on like a little table. So the housekeeper claps her hands, you know, in the mom's face, and the mom springs up into perfect posture and also dazed like a robot. Like she was like clapped on like the clapper. It was bizarre. Whatever. So the mom comes in. Kiwoo starts the interview. Kiwoo slash Kevin is obviously a bit uncomfortable and self-conscious about the documents and the nature of the interview, but he's basically in after he lets the mother sit in on a tutoring session. And in that tutoring session, he is flirting with the teenager. He grabs her wrist and he talks about her heartbeat and has this noble speech about being confident during these exams. And the mom is impressed and the daughter is all flustered. While he is being walked out of the really icky concrete palace by the mom is talking about her youngest, Da Song, needing a therapist of some kind. And then Kiwoo gets the idea to recommend his sister. But he can't just say it's his sister because that is not impressive. So he comes up with Jessica. And Jessica is another person with a white American name who is really smart and spent time in the States, according to Kiwoo, Kevin. Jessica is a high-demand, very expensive and successful art therapist who comes highly recommended. And let's talk about the power of a recommendation. In Korean work culture, being recommended for a job is basically sometimes the only way you can get a job. Sure, you can apply, you can go to school, you can do your biz, you can get your experience, whatever. But if you want a good chance at getting the job, you better know someone. Sound familiar? That's how it's been for me most times. Back to this very relevant story. Kiwoo slash Kevin recommends Ki Jung slash Jessica. Kiwoo and Ki Jung, they are related. But Jessica and Kevin hardly know each other. And Ki Jung, she kills the interview. She even gets the kid to calm down and focus. I do want to mention that Ki Jung really picked up her Jessica character very well. Ki Jung is, she's faking it all, just like Kiwoo. But they are both so talented and intelligent in their own regard that they are pulling this shit off. And it's fun. And it's fun to watch them do this because you're rooting for them. You're like, yeah. Fuck those rich people. Get into that house. Get that money. Get your family in there and survive, you know? And Jessica also fits in very well with the Park family. She has the same demeanor. She has the same clothes. She cut her hair. She also treats the working class the same. She doesn't make eye contact or regard the housekeeper as a part of the family unit. And she just, like, Ki Jung just, like, easily fits into this role. So now we have two of the four Kim family members in the house. Kiwoo and Ki Jung work together on getting their mother and father from the Kim family into the Park family's domestic team. Ki Jung spots a job for her dad, Kai Tech, and the job she spots is the driver. And then Kiwoo and Ki Jung work together to get the housekeeper position for their mother. And this starts a whole orchestration of a plan that consists of planting panties and peach fuzz. The driver is ordered by Mr. Park to take Jessica home. On the drive home, she takes off her panties and she plants them underneath the seat in front of her. The panties are found by Mr. Park the following day. My God, the upper echelon spiral that these rainbow panties cause. So Mr. Park brings home the discount rainbow panties. He sniffed them in the car. So Mr. Park is bringing the panties home, and he brings them home to the very paranoid Mrs. Park, who is stunned, shocked, appalled, afraid, disgusted, terrified, curious, enraged, all these things. And Mrs. Park ends up handling them with tongs and plastic gloves. Then the Parks immediately assume that these panties belong to a wild woman of the night. Because the woman they belong to has no self-respect. Because who leaves panties behind? Who has sex in a car? Troubled women with drug addiction. Like, who hasn't forgotten their panties somewhere? Who hasn't gotten busy in the back of a Buick? The Park family is very out of touch with the real world. Yeah, so what? You found some panties. It's a panty panic. So, boom. The driver is out and the dad is in after a little bit of an awkward interview. So, Kai Tech, his character within the Park family is Mr. Kim. And Mr. Kim also has experience living in America as a big shot chauffeur. So yeah, he got the job. He's from America and there's a recommendation. Yeah, let's just fire this guy over some rainbow panties and let's get the stranger in here ASAP. So now the dad, daughter, and son of the Kim family all work together to get the mom the housekeeper job. The family plans and studies and rehearses the scripts together. That was like a super favorite. I really did like that scene where they're all like practicing the lines at their house and like the dad is trying to practice his lines and then you see the mom in the background mouthing the lines for him. Everyone's mouthing the lines. Anyway, so the family scrapes off peach fuzz and sneakily sprinkles the fuzz on the housekeeper when she isn't looking. So when the housekeeper is having like these multiple allergic reactions, the family starts their plan of making Mrs. Park paranoid about the housekeeper. They literally get away with convincing Mrs. Park that the housekeeper has tuberculosis. This scene, or part of the first half, was funny. And it was funny and fun to watch the family pull off this master plan. So, blammo. Now the housekeeper is kicked out and fired. So the driver is fired and replaced. The nanny is fired and replaced. The tutor is grooming the girl, and the art therapist is full of shit. This is the Park family residence. So the Kim family is going about their lives with the Park family. Everything is going swimmingly, with a little scare here and there, like the little boy. He notices that Mr. Kim and Chung Suk, the housekeeper, the new housekeeper, they smell the same due to the basement smell of their home. But of course, the Parks dismiss the curious coincidence and move about their day eating peaches in their home for the first time. And the smell, I learned, was also a symbol that turns into a motif because it just keeps reoccurring. Apparently, the smell is supposed to represent like how you cannot escape the fact that you're poor, even though you have a job, even though you're parading around like Jessica and Kevin and Mr. Kim. Like, even though you're putting on this show and you're doing it well and you're getting money, it does not change the fact that you're still poor. You still live in a basement and that smell clings to you. So, yeah, symbolism. So then the Parks decide to go on vacation. Camping. And rich people camping will always fascinate and infuriate me. Rich people, you know, they'll tell you they're going camping and what they're excited about. And it sounds a little something like this. Oh, yes. Oh, we're taking a delightful little camping trip upstate. It's nice to get out of the city and smell the fresh air, see some green, give the children a break from the screen time. And I know I could use a break from the city and managing this house. It's a lot of work being a housewife. You know, we have been so stressed out lately with getting our youngest son, little Bitchington III, trying to find him a decent school that can cater to his super specific intellectual needs. Because, you know, we are the type of people to spawn the world's next Einstein. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, go look at a tree and come back a changed person. Whatever. And it was funny to see that, like, Mrs. Park is, like, running around. She's collecting and packing so much shit just to go camping. And even has Mrs. Kim, like, help her pack a camping projector. So the Park family leaves. And they leave the house under Mrs. Kim, the housekeeper. They leave it under her care. And while the Park family is away, the Kim family will come and play in the Park's house. So the Kims are, like, fucking around in the Park's home, eating their snacks, drinking a lot of their booze, using the bath, playing out in the yard, reading their diaries, going into all of their rooms. And this next part is one of the coolest parts of the movie. So this next scene has one of the coolest parts of the movie. This is the scene where everyone from the Kim family is sitting down at that coffee table in the empty Park house late at night. And the Kim family is like stuffing their faces with the Park's snacks and finishing off all of their booze. And the family is sitting on one side of the table because technically, like, they're looking out at the window So the Kim family is sitting on one side of the table, and the camera, us, the audience, is sitting on the other side of the table. So it's like we're in the room with them, sitting across from them at the table. So there's the Kim family and us, the audience. We're all just hanging out around this coffee table. We're eating snacks, getting drunk, talking about life, sharing our success, and we're celebrating. We're laughing. We're feeling light with this drunk behavior. We're sinking into the openly dropped inhibitions. And I watched this movie, that second time that I watched the movie, I was watching it again with my partner, Tarek. Something jumped out at me during this scene that I didn't notice when I was watching this by myself, which is also just like another reason why watching movies in a theater is like a completely different experience than watching it streaming, because you're in a room with a group of people and you guys are acting like a collective because you're all watching the same shit on the same screen. Or people are making out. I don't know. So anyway, so this scene starts, you know, Tarek and I were chuckling. And then we are given a joke. The movie Parasite gives us a joke. Us, the audience. This movie gives us a joke that we would absolutely laugh at, or even if we don't laugh at it, we understand how silly it is and our hearts actually lighten and we loosen up. And the joke is, the daughter realizes, you know, she's been eating dog treats this whole time. So we laugh. Ha 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 ha. She's been eating dog food. The family laughs at her. Ha 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 ha. Ki-jung has been eating dog food. Now we're all laughing. Ha 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 ha. And then the doorbell rings, and both the laughter on screen and in my living room stopped simultaneously and on a fucking dime. It was crazy and really fucking cool. And it was like psychological movie magic or something. And I do wonder what that was like in theaters. Okay, if you saw this in the theater, do you remember that happening? Did everyone react the same? God, I really miss going to the movies. I really miss going out into theaters. Anyway, this is the moment, this doorbell moment, this dog food to doorbell moment. This is when we start to transition to the second half of the movie. We go from watching this fun, fast-paced, relatable first half. We go from watching that like a comedy almost, like immediately switches to a thriller. And it's a thriller with like plot twists and murder. And here we are in the second fucking half of this movie. The second half of Parasite holds all the reasons why good people will refuse to discuss the plot with you if you have not seen the movie. This is the half of the movie where shit gets buck fucking wild. You don't know who to root for, who to hate, who to feel for. The characters change or let go of their morals. And good Lord, this movie has hidden twist after hidden twist. So there's a ring-a-ling at the door. And if it were me, I would not answer. I'd turn off all the lights, hide behind the couch, you know. But I would watch that fancy little camera that they have. But, you know, the Kim family is full of adults. So, of course, someone answered the doorbell intercom thingy. And who is ringing the doorbell at this hour in the night? It's the old housekeeper. God, and the housekeeper was really, really creepy during this half of the movie. She is beaten and bloodied and trying really hard to seem okay by giggling. It's not working. And she is asking to come inside. This is where we start screaming at the screen, right? Don't do it! And then you question your own humanity because this woman that this family fucked over is now all bloody and out in the rain asking to come into the house that she has lived in and cared for the past few years. And we're all over here like, fuck you, get the fuck out of here. So the housekeeper is let in. The old housekeeper goes downstairs to get something she forgot or whatever and is really fucking creepy about it. She goes down to the basement by herself and is missing for a while. And the Kim family is hiding in bushes and running on their tippy toes all over the place, rolling under tables like little Mission Impossible spies. And the housekeeper going downstairs, this is where the first twist is revealed. The door to the bunker. Jung-suk and the housekeeper move this giant display case full of pickled prunes. And behind this display case, there's a door, a bunker door. The housekeeper flies down into the bunker. She's screaming, and Jung-suk cautiously runs after her and is like, "What the hell is going on?" And then we are slapped with another twist and reveal. The housekeeper's husband, he's this pathetic-looking man. And I mean that in the best way possible. He's not pathetic, but his condition was. Turns out he's been living under that house ever since the last owner. And the display case was blocking the door, so he couldn't get out, leaving him to starve. I was surprised at Jung-suk's hypocritical reaction to all of this. Her first reaction is, "Well, I need to call the police now. There's nothing else I can do. I'm so sorry. It's out of my hands, but I have to call the police." And it's almost like the income change for the Kim family, which was just them getting jobs. That income change for the Kim family has made Jung-suk feel superior to the couple in the bunker. So while the housekeeper is begging for Jung-suk's mercy, the Kim family, they fall right onto the floor of the bunker. We have Kai-taek, Ki-jung, Ki-woo, they all just like faceplant onto the floor of the bunker. And then the power in this scene immediately falls into the housekeeper's hands. She takes an incriminating video of the Kim family and threatens to send it to the Park family. And is even holding up the phone like a gun. And the Kim family even holds their hands up and back away in surrender, as if it was the gun. So the Kims are held hostage upstairs. And the housekeeper takes a second video of the Kims answering to their real titles of mother, father, son, and daughter. And this, I think, is done so the housekeeper can show the Parks a video that does not involve the bunker, which saves the whole basement husband situation. The housekeeping couple drops their guard for 1 second, and then the entire Kim family attacks. They full-on attack this couple. 4 against 2. We aren't punching or kicking yet, but there is tackling, grappling, holding down, yelling, screaming, dogpiling, and the daughter, Ki-jung, goes to the kitchen and grabs a peach and then comes back to the brawl and is shoving this peach in the housekeeper's face. Like, damn, dude, that freaks me out, Ki-jung. And remind me not to get into a brawl with Ki-jung. Whether she is on my side or not, she will just end up taking it to that level. In the middle of this brawl, the phone rings. The housekeeper and the husband are restrained, and Jung-suk answers the phone. And shocker, the Park family is coming home early from the camping trip because it's raining. Were the conditions not perfect enough to live outdoors, you fucking shits? But you know, it turns out the campsite was flooded, so you know, fine. Come home then. She starts to order that Miss Kim should cook a fancy fucking meal. And this meal is symbolic. Japaguri is the dish that was requested. And I noticed that Jung-suk didn't even know what japaguri was. I didn't know what the fuck it was either. Which told me that japaguri is rich people food, but it is symbolic to the story. Japaguri, also called ramdon, which is a mix of ramen and udon noodles. The symbolism comes in when Mrs. Kim is adding this very expensive-looking marbled meat steak. So the symbolism is it's a mix of the lower class and upper class. So we have lower class dining, which is the noodles, and the upper class dining, which is the meat. And I think the steak looked like Wagyu, but this stuff is expensive and it's a delicacy. But for the Parks, it'll do as a last minute midnight snack. Obnoxious. Parasite also made this japaguri, ramdon, this dish, very popular. So next time you're out and you see it on the menu, indulge. Why not? Have it for a midnight snack. Ask for some aged marble steak to be sprinkled on top of it. Why not? But also during this cooking scene, the entire Kim family is scrambling to clean up this house. It's almost like those cleanup scenes you would see in a party movie. Like, oh no, mom and dad are almost here, gotta clean up. But in Parasite, this moment isn't as funny. It's really stressful and a little fun, but stressful and kind of horrifying. So Ki-jung is sweeping the shattered glass under the table and she actually ends up cutting her hand. Ki-woo and Kai-tek are struggling to get the housekeeper and her husband tied up and taken downstairs into the bunker. The housekeeper even comes back up the stairs, bound and gagged, and Chung-suk donkey kicks the housekeeper down the steps. This kick, it was the cherry on top of this stressful and horrific turn in the story. Like this whole scramble to clean up the house is like this mixture of comedy and horror. It's like helping the entire movie like start to transition. It just showed that the characters are starting to change. Their morals are starting to change. Like Chung-suk didn't even hesitate. She didn't even hesitate to kick that woman. And she wasn't even fazed about kicking this restrained, allergic reaction riddled, beaten and bloodied middle-aged woman down the steps. So the Parks come home. And during this moment, they seem like a normal family for once. They're scrambling to settle into their home after canceled plans. Restless kid, bored teen, and the parents are all over the place just trying to corral everyone into PJs and bed. And the daughter goes to her room and she almost catches Ki-woo, which is fucking stressful, but she doesn't. And then Ki-woo ends up downstairs under the living room table. I think it's a living room. I don't know. So Ki-woo ends up under the coffee table with his dad and his sister and the broken glass and the garbage like a bunch of cockroaches. Then the night starts to die down and it looks like the Kim family is about to be freed. And then the little boy, Da-song, decides to camp out on the lawn and Mr. and Mrs. Park decide to camp out in the living room that has a big window looking out onto the lawn. Mr. and Mrs. Park are lying on the couch talking about their stupid fucking lives. And Mr. Park brings up Mr. Kim. Mr. Park doesn't know how to feel about Mr. Kim. And he says that Mr. Kim had a certain smell, like an odor. And this odor could be speculated to be a real odor. The Kim family does live in a basement. Maybe they can't do laundry with super fancy soaps or whatever. Like, who knows, right? I was wondering that. I was wondering if this smell was real or metaphorical or whatever. Until the Parks were like, yeah, he has that smell. He smells like the people who take the subway. So then I was like, oh, you are talking about stinky poor people. And that conversation made me angry. The Parks are just so fucking obnoxious and stupid. Genuinely stupid, and they have all the fucking money. Ugh. And then Mr. Park and Mrs. Park start to engage in sad rich people sex. But it continues to be fucked up when the dirty talk comes in. Mrs. Park is asking Mr. Park if he still has the panties. Yeah, the Ki-jung panties. And then Mrs. Park wants to role play as a person with an addiction issue, and it's getting her off. And it's getting him off too. Gross! And Ki-tek has to listen to all of this. He's humiliated from being called stinky. Then he's further humiliated because Mr. Park can never respect him because he's poor. Then he has to listen to these gross rich assholes fantasize about his daughter's panties and, you know, suffering poor people. That's a lot, dude. That's a lot to take in. I'm just saying. Then the Parks finally go to sleep. I know, they can sleep at night. How are they able to do that? And we are smacked with more and more suspense during the Kim family's escape. So Da-song, he's out in the lawn, he turns on that flashlight, shines it directly into the living room, and his flashlight is basically blinding his parents. But thank God, because they don't see Kai-tek lying on the floor right in front of them. Woohoo! And I think that's also a defense mechanism of a cockroach. It's just to stay still, don't move. So Ki-woo, Ki-jung, and their dad, Kai-tek, are now running home in the pouring rain. We see shots of them running down the hill, to run down another hill, down again to another street that's going downhill, down a flight of stairs, and then they take a break. And they aren't the only ones catching their breath. I was too. What the hell was all of that? I thought we were having a good time. And then everything got flipped so quickly. Y'all did not keep it cool back there, Kims. And then Ki-jung, she looks shaken and not the cool cucumber she usually is. Everyone is soaked, and the rain is relentless. It is still pouring down. And Ki-jung is like, so what the hell are we going to do about the couple in the basement? Like, holy shit. That's right. Y'all, all of y'all, bound, gagged, and beat the shit out of a couple, and then you tied them up in the basement of this big-ass house. I guess all of the suspenseful cockroaching around the house kind of made us forget that. What are you gonna do about the fucking couple? What do you do? Where do you go from here? So the three of them put a pin in it, and they keep moving forward, or downward. The Parks must live at the top of a mountain or something, or the Kims must live in a valley or a pit. Or both could be true. The Kims come up on their block, and it is at this point that we, as an audience, and maybe even the Kim family, this is kind of where we all kind of remember that the Kims still live in a basement. They don't live in a giant fancy house. They live in a basement at the bottom of a valley. The Kims trudge through sewer water. Because remember, that's what flood water is, y'all. If you haven't lived it, you may not know, but a majority of flood water is piss and shit because the sewers are overflowing. I'm sure a few floods are from like rivers and other bodies of water, but if there is a sewer system nearby and there's like those grates in the street, you know what I mean? Those overflow and that water is mainly piss and shit. Just saying. So they're trudging through the water. People are throwing buckets of water over their shoulders. It's hitting Ki-tek in the face and everyone's getting splashed with this dirty, dirty water, but it doesn't stop the Kim family. Ki-tek doesn't stop. Ki-woo doesn't stop. And I know that the dad told the daughter, like, stay there, you know, this is dangerous, doesn't stop her. She's still going forward. So then the Kims discover that the window was left open and the entire apartment is going under. The water is rushing in. And Ki-woo is desperately trying to close the window, but he keeps getting shocked because all of the electric outlets, appliances, and all that shit for the block, everything's underwater, and who knows if there are any loose wires or bad electric repair jobs submerged, because who has the money for repairs? And Ki-tek is gathering all the belongings that he can, his wife's shot put metal. And all three members of the Kim family have monumental moments in this short scene. Let's start with Ki-jung. She has one of the coolest shots in the movie. It's not a cool moment for her, but it's powerful. She goes into the bathroom, and the toilet is there, and it's on this higher level than the entire bathroom, so you have to, like, climb up those steps, those, like, tile slippery steps to get onto the platform. So during the flood, this toilet is spewing shit everywhere. Ki-jung is up to her waist, almost chest in sewer water. She has shit, literal brown, black shit, getting blasted in her face. And she is climbing these stairs and she closes that toilet seat lid, which doesn't do much because the pressure of the spew is so strong that the poop and stuff is shooting out from all the cracks in between the toilet and the lid. And she just calmly sits on top of the lid. She pulls her knees up to her chest. She removes a panel from the drop ceiling above her head, and she pulls out of the ceiling a stash of cigarettes with money attached to the outside, like a little wallet. And she just takes out a crisp, white, dry cigarette that is also getting tainted by, you know, Ki-jung's shit-soaked fingers and face and mouth. And she just lights the fucking cigarette. And we get this wide shot of her, and she's smoking the cigarette. Shit is still spewing everywhere. I really cannot put into words how this scene makes me feel or how this shot makes me feel. It just reminds me of all the times in my life when my life was falling apart or when life was lifing the fuck out of me. But anyway, this was still my favorite moment of the movie. And then we have Ki-tek. Ki-tek has had one hell of a day. And by this point, the water is up to his neck. And he has a small box full of their belongings. And then he just stops as the water is coming in. The lights are flickering and about to go out. And he just looks at his home and he just sees devastation. And there's even more that him and his family need to overcome. And that apartment, That apartment did not stand a chance against anything like this. And then Ki-woo. Ki-woo has a bit of an experience that I am still trying to hash out. And we have a fan theory. Woo! Yes, I love fan theories. So Ki-woo is wading in the waters within his home, probably not even knowing what to take with him. He's in shock. And then the rock makes a super questionable but very intentional reappearance. Ki-woo finds the rock. Some say the rock found him. Ki-woo is in the kitchen looking around for something, and then he looks down. And in slow motion, through the murky waters and flashing lights, the rock seems to float into Ki-woo's hands. And it's true. It does. The rock fucking floats. It floats. The rock fucking floats. So when you're watching the scene back, you see Ki-woo's hands in the water. They're in the water. You don't see them go deep into the water. They're in the water and they don't move. The hands don't move. And the rock floats up. And all Ki-woo has to do is just open his hands and get the rock. He doesn't reach down into the water. It wasn't sitting on a stool because it goes from the depths to the surface on its own. Okay? And it's in slow motion. Intentional. It was not sitting on a stool. It was not sitting on the little countertop, which is, I think, where we last saw it. But it floated. So this sparks the theory of, is this fucking rock a fake? Like we know in the movie. We know the movie magic of it being made of foam, okay? We know that. But in the movie, in this Park Kim reality, is this rock fake and fucking hollow? Because if it was, then it could symbolize false hope or false dreams in regards to spending your life chasing after money or social status. It could also symbolize all of the crap we deem valuable and how gullible rich people are because they will buy anything that looks pretty and has a good story or a big exclusionary price tag and then they use it as a status symbol. Or was it Ki-woo's imagination? Maybe he imagines that this rock has risen to the surface and placed itself in his hands like it was asking to be rescued. Or maybe it was rescuing him. Maybe it was his perception we were seeing. Or maybe it was both. Maybe the rock floated up into his hands and he read really deep into it. Picking delusion over reality. You know what I mean? Hey, sometimes you have to. Sometimes you have to. But then people argue that the rock has been treated like a heavy object since it was introduced. And I didn't really pick up on that when I first watched the movie. This is what I thought. So I know when the friend came into the apartment to give the rock, I know he called it heavy. But the way he said it, I thought he was calling Ki-woo emaciated. At the start of the movie, Ki-woo was a weenie. He was skinny, uninvolved in anything. So I thought the friend was like, careful, Ki-woo, this rock is heavy for you. Or maybe the weight was in the custom wooden box. Or maybe the friend was so rich, he didn't really have any experience with lifting heavy things or any experience with like rocks. I don't know. And then we cut to the shelter. So I guess their day really ends in a shelter. Oh my God. Oh, that's awful. Okay, so their day ends at the shelter. The shelter is crowded, loud, and absolutely chaotic. Just more and more chaos and so much fucking noise. And I don't think the Kim family has ever really had the time throughout this movie to rest. Maybe when the plan worked for a bit, but that was short-lived. But in the shelter, there are piles of clothes guarded by people in vests, and arguments are breaking out everywhere. And in this shelter scene, Ki-woo and Kai-tek have a conversation about not having a plan. The dad is defeated and is saying that there is no plan because that's not how life works. With no plan, nothing can go wrong. And if something spins out of control, it doesn't matter. It's like he's giving up or he's giving in to this unnatural way of living within this capitalist caste system. And this is where Ki-woo admits that he feels the rock is clinging to him. Let's continue the rock breakdown. The rock is just as much of a part of this movie as anything else. Did the rock win the Oscar? I hope. Beautiful performance. So to continue the Rock breakdown, I just looked up some videos from the movie, and it does look like the Rock is heavy, or that it's too heavy for Kiwoo to casually carry. So I do think it is heavy and not hollow, and that it is indeed just a fucking rock. The Rock seems to remind Kiwoo of his rich, fancy friend, and that it could possibly bring Kiwoo to the same level as his fancy friend. So he clutches to this belief that this rock does have the power to bring in good fortune and wealth. And especially in low times like this, it is natural for people to cling to any belief that will lead them out to the other side. I mean, when you had nothing and you still seem to lose everything, sure, why not believe in the mystical powers of this metaphor symbol rock thing? So while in the shelter, the next day, the next morning, Ki-jung, she gets a call from Mrs. Park. And Mrs. Park is asking Ki-jung to come out to a party that afternoon. And that pissed me the fuck off. A few hours notice? So the party is for the little boy, Da-song. And Mrs. Park wants Ki-jung, aka Jessica, to be there. And Ki-jung, you know, she somehow gets a really nice white cottage chic dress. Maybe from like the shelter pile or something. And she gets out to this party. Mr. Kim is also called into work to do a favor for Mr. Park. And of course, Kevin is invited by the daughter. And Mrs. Kim has been working this whole fucking time. Now we are at this really lame kids party that didn't really have kids. And the theme is like genocide or colonizer or something. There's a wood chopping station and bow and arrows everywhere. Rich people are smiling for some fucking reason. And the teepee is like in the center of it all. Kiwoo is upstairs mindlessly making out with the daughter. But she can tell. She knows he is empty inside. She can feel it. At this point, it just seems like he's already realized what he is doing or what he has to do to keep this plan going. And it hits him. He has to kill the couple downstairs, and he's going to do it with the rock. We'll come back to that. Then we have Ki-jung. Ki-jung is trying to talk to her mom, Chung-suk. I'm like whispering because I don't want the rich people to hear. And we really gotta be sneaky right now because we can't have the rich people knowing that Jessica is talking to somebody in the kitchen because I don't even know if that's like socially acceptable or not. Anyway, so Ki-jung is trying to talk to her mom, Chung-suk, downstairs in the kitchen without anyone noticing. And her and her mom are like, last night was crazy, right? That was nuts. And the mom is like, yeah, we got so carried away. It was so crazy. Why don't you go down there and give them some of this food? I bet they are so hungry. Like, y'all, I think the couple downstairs needs more than just a plate of spaghetti and a monstrously large meatball. So Ki-jung takes the plate and is about to go downstairs. And then Mrs. Park is like, oh my God, Jessica! Just the status symbol I was looking for. We need you to bring out the cake to show how civilized and cured our amazing son is. And then she takes Ki-jung away with the giant plate of food. So back to the son, Kiwoo. So Kiwoo takes this heavy-ass rock, timidly, and he's going downstairs, he opens up the bunker, he starts going down the bunker steps, and then he ends up dropping the rock, and it slippity slaps its way down to the steps, and it lands with a big fucking bang. Ugh, I'm getting stressed. So while the Kim family has been away working and dealing with their flooding dwellings, the couple downstairs has been like descending into madness. The wife actually dies from a concussion, and the husband loses it. And the wife dies after tearing her husband free with her teeth. That is a real one right there. All right. I also think I skipped over the biggest twist and reveal of the movie. The husband in the basement was in control of the automated lights on the stairs. He sings praises to Mr. Park when he comes home. And while he is like turning on these motion sensor lights, and he does this when Mr. Park or anyone is walking up the stairs. And this guy has an unnatural respect and like praise for Mr. Park. Like he worships Mr. Park like a god. And he also used the lights as Morse code to talk to the little Boy Scout, DeSong. So Ki-Woo follows this big-ass rock down the steps, and he finds the body of the wife. And while he is staring in shock and horror at her body bag, he is attacked by the husband. And it's so fucking intense. You just know Ki-Woo is done for. Ki-Woo somehow like breaks free for a second. He grabs his rock and he's running up these cement steps. And he had like that rope around his neck. And it's like you grab the rock, but you don't gather the string. I don't even know if he knew he had the string around his neck. But anyway, he has this rope around his neck and it's trailing behind him. And ultimately, as soon as he gets to the top of the steps into the basement, he just gets pulled back. And Ki-Woo is just like clotheslined hard. Then the crazed husband comes up the stairs and he takes the beloved rock and smashes it twice on Ki-Woo's head, leaving Ki-Woo twitching and unconscious in his own pool of blood. And this rock, yeah, we're talking about the fucking rock again. This rock, to me, felt like the false hope some people can cling to when they are down and out. There is a massive void, you know, that opens up in you after life has just like stabbed so many holes in you. And sometimes people look to fill that void with vices, toxic relationships, with jobs and behaviors, and dare I say, religion. Ki-Woo was clinging onto and trusting that this rock was the answer. It was this symbol of wealth, this magnet for fortune. But honestly, it was just a big, clumsy, heavy rock that ended up being turned into a weapon that gave him a permanent brain injury that caused him to smile and laugh no matter the situation. And the rock to me, you know, said it before, it just like felt like a symbol of religion or false hope that is usually fed to those in shit situations by people in wealthy or high class situations. And I have a lot of anxiety saying that. I have a lot of anxiety admitting that. But this is my true experience with watching this fucking rock. Maybe it's my history with religion and that religious society that I grew up in. But if religion works for you and it brings you peace and you don't weaponize it to oppress others, nice, you know, great. But sometimes when it's in the wrong hands, it'll be weaponized and you'll be beaten senseless until you're just smiling and laughing and being the perfect image. So, after the husband comes up from the basement, he is in a state, but is very focused and picks up a knife and calmly walks out to the party. This is where the daughter is stabbed, and Kai-Tek goes to help his daughter, who was just fucking stabbed. And meanwhile, the Park family is yelling at him because their son passed out or had another seizure, and they need the car, and I guess they also need Mr. Kim to drive it. Like, really? You can't drive your own fucking car just this fucking once? And the thing is, they have two fucking cars. They have two cars. And I don't think Mr. Kim has keys to both of them, right? He only drives that town car. And then they take that big SUV thing to go camping. Like, I know that no one knows that Ki-Tek is Ki-Jung's father. But she was stabbed, dude. She was stabbed. And it also shows that no matter how much Jessica fit in, she was still viewed as unimportant by the Park family because they could care less that she was bleeding to death in their backyard. Ugh. So the crazed husband is still attacking the partygoers. And then Chung-Sook, she grabs one of the axes from that chopping wood station. She like charges this man. She like runs after him and she fucking throws down with this guy. I really appreciated that. I really appreciated this stage combat because it was just like actual fighting. Like she's an athlete. She's a mother. She's like has like this like stockier, strong build. And her daughter was just stabbed. Yeah, she's gonna fucking take an axe to this man's face. Of course. And I just really appreciate that she just wasn't immediately slung to the side by some man who only needed like one arm to sling her to the floor. Which, you know, is like the usual fight scene between a man and a woman in movies. But no, Chung-Sook had a fucking axe. And she is fighting for her life and her family's life. And she ends up delivering the final blow by stabbing this man with a kebab skewer that is the size of a samurai sword. Holy hell. And the Park family is still yelling at Kai Tech to get the fucking car. So Kai Tech throws the keys to Mr. Park, but he's throwing the keys right when the crazed husband is like kebabbed and the keys fall underneath his body. Then Mr. Park goes to reach for the keys and he has to like roll the guy over and he's just met with a stench and he pinches his nose with his thumb and his index finger and then the rest of his fingers on that hand are just like splayed out. It's like he was touching poop. This just filled me with so much rage. Just like, what a little bitch. And this makes Kai Tech snap. And then he stabs and kills Mr. Park. And Kai Tech runs and hides within the bunker. Time passes. No one knows where Kai Tech really is. And Ki Jung has passed away. Then the remaining Kims, mother and son, they go on trial and they are released on probation. And Ki Woo is suffering from a permanent brain injury that makes him laugh and smile constantly. Then we have the end moment. We see the father trying to speak Morse code from the basement with the light switches. He is sneaking food from whoever buys the house. He buries the housekeeper. But in that shot, she is not in the body bag. And she still looks fresh and floppy, if you know what I mean. So I'm wondering if he actually got to bury her, or is she still down there and he is just writing a nice little ending for her? And he is writing this letter to his son, a letter that will likely never be read. And we also see the son like sneaking up to the house to spy on the family inside, but more so for this Morse code. Then the son is writing to his father. We hear Ki Woo's words and his new plan, and we see this beautiful ending. We were shown the ending that we wanted. The boy gets successful and rich. He's wearing a suit. He meets with a realtor. He buys the house. His mother will now be taken care of. His father will come up from the fallout shelter. Hardly any facial hair has grown. His hair is still on the shorter side. Like, yay, you know, like the son was able to succeed so quickly. And the dad slowly and stricken walks out from the bunker into the house during the daytime, and the sound goes out completely. But the visuals are so pleasant. Finally, a moment of peace for this family and us as the audience. We all get some peace from this nonstop overstimulation, and the crushing demand of capitalism is not within these walls. And then, aww, a group hug for the Kim family. Then the screen fades to black. And as an audience, we are waiting for the credits to roll. And instead of the credits rolling in, the next scene rolls in. Slowly, from the bottom of the screen to the top, just like the credits should. But it's not the credits, it's reality. We see Ki Woo in the basement apartment with his mom working in the background. The same socks still hanging in the window. This now disabled man, Ki Woo, has to hold on to his delusions while his mother, who is also on probation, has to care for him, and life goes on. Just as hard as before, if not worse. And then the credits roll. And damn, what a fucking movie. I definitely had to put it down for a few days because thinking about capitalism this much just like hurts and it's infuriating. But I had some questions. Who is the parasite? The poor family? The rich family? The weird couple? The rock? The money? What is it? Kind of all of it, right? The house is a host. The Parks can also be seen as the host and a parasite. The poor family is the parasite because of how they made space and took over the home. The crazed couple could also be the parasite because they lived off the Park family's resources and dwelled within the home. The rich family, and the rich in general, are parasites because they hoard and drain all of the resources of the land and its people, causing mass poverty and lack of resources and space for others. And don't forget about the little boy and all the references to Native Americans and the mom's obsession with the USA. Colonizers are also parasites. The rock could also be parasitic because it fed emotionally and mentally on the boy, or honestly, anyone who has faith in its powers. But the rock didn't benefit from it because, you know, because it's just still a fucking rock. But my biggest question about all of this was, what the fuck do rich people think of this? What do the fucking rich people of this world that I fucking live in, what do they think of this? And I know they fucking saw it. This movie won the Best Picture Award at the Oscars, and it was the first international film to do so, so y'all fucking saw it! So against my better judgment, I Googled it. I Googled, what did the rich think about Parasite, the movie? This is the result I found via Vice. This is Chrissy Teigen and Elon Musk's Skiz's favorite movie. It just hurts knowing how stupid and detached the rich are. Idiots. And Teigen and Musk are very lost individuals with very cruel histories with the lower class. And I think the rocket ship should take off now. Just start the countdown and get them out of here. God, what a wild concept. Rich people believing that they can escape to space on their own. It's going to get petty because someone's going to want their own private shuttle. There's going to be complaints, overpacking, boring stories, and lifeless jokes, and not a single enjoyable food on that flight. If getting the wrong coffee order sets them off, do they understand how much of an inconvenience the end of the world will be? No, they don't. But still, you know, farewell, rich people. We will be okay, quite okay without you. Go ahead and pack up, put on your little space suits and blast off, babies. The stars are waiting for you. So I didn't intentionally mean to go beat for beat with this one originally. And, you know, I'm assuming that you have seen the movie before. So I'm, you know, I hope that this was at least enjoyable and made you think back to the movie and rehash it right along with me. I felt everything in this movie. This movie was powerful. It did make me feel like seen it, or not like me feel seen, but at least like it was like calling out the fucking issues of the world. And that to me, it's like this weird feeling. It's not like happiness that I'm feeling. It's just like I do feel angry and enraged, but it feels good. I don't know how to explain it. I know there's a word for it, but like it's just like, oh, exactly. You know? Keep on going, my friends. Keep being a menace to the rich. Eat them. Eat them up. There you have it. That is my experience with Parasite the movie. I don't think of it. I know I've had parasites before. I'm not going to fill you in on that. So thank you so much for listening to yet another really long episode about a movie that's on my really long list. And next week, we will be digging into The Matrix. Yes, I've never seen The Matrix. Gives me anxiety always saying that. And also next week, next episode, I have my very first ever guest. That's right. I invite my sibling, my eldest sibling, Casey, to come and join the fun here on Lucky's really long list of movies. And I'm so thankful that they did because the recording took about 6 hours, but that is not how long the podcast is. But it's fun. We yell at each other. We make jokes. We confess things to each other, like what other movies we haven't seen. And then I also have some fun with making some fake commercials. So if you're interested in that, stick around and catch us on Monday when we talk about The Matrix. And if you want to go ahead and watch The Matrix, you can do that. I watched it on Max. I think Max has like all of the Matrix movies. You can also see it on Pluto TV for free, or you can rent it on YouTube, Google Play, Apple TV, Fandango, or Amazon Prime. All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I hope to see you for the next one. Goodbye.